Do my little introduction.
Today is August 22nd, 2013. This is Janice Dilge, oral historian for the U.S. District Court of Oregon Historical Society. And this is the fourth interview with Michael Hogan at his Office of Hogan Mediation in Eugene, Oregon. Good morning.
Good morning.
We were speaking last time about several significant cases that you were involved in. There were a couple of more that I wanted to touch on with you. And one was you did some rulings in 2010 on the Oregon's initiative and referendum law, which was passed in 1902 and has really become part of the Oregon political landscape. And talk about what the case was that came before you and your ruling on that and how that's kind of played out in the landscape since then.
That could be a couple, so tell me what subject matter I have in mind.
So you were ruling on paid petitioners, and there had been a case brought that was going to prohibit core political speech, I believe was the term that was used. So talk a bit about how you came to your judgment on that question.
Well, I haven't reviewed that for a long time.
Okay.
But it's true that the First Amendment is very broad, at both in what someone says and what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, that openness that our Constitution provides for is very important in the type of freedom as we know it in this country, as compared to many places where when there's pressure put to hold down speech or action and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you get into paying someone to put someone on the ballot, you bring another aspect into the equation, of course, and is that appropriate or not? Well, again, I think the First Amendment is very broad. And so, as a judge, I didn't have any concern about some individual political question or that sort of thing. I think it's all instead part of protecting expression that we have. And just how those lines are drawn in each situation can be difficult. And frankly, it has more to do with the particular facts of a situation than theory on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I nevertheless think we need to protect this openness of expression. And as long as we have full disclosure of what's happening, then people ought to have a chance to basically do what they want. So I think that, as a foundational matter, that was it.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, after you rule on, you know, an issue like this,
mm-hmm.
clearly that continues to play out in the public political process. Do you follow that, and how, you know, what are the ramifications of your ruling, or not so much?
Not at all, as a matter of fact. The Constitution needs to be looked at as really the document on which our government is based. And if we become result-oriented in constitutional questions, we're starting at the wrong place. You've turned the process upside down. So I don't think you do that at all. And it's true with really any law. Let's say there's a law you disagree with. Well, my theory is, if there's a law you disagree with, but it's constitutional, you enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
And people will see that it's changed at that point, rather than ignore it or try to make it something it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And if, on something as basic as freedom of expression or freedom of choice or freedom of religion, all those things, we need to protect those as really precious. And a particular result can't guide our consideration. Let's face it, it'll have a different application next year And if we do it one way, we should expect to see that through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at some of the controversial issues, I really didn't ever have many cases having to do with sort of rights of privacy. I had some. But if you look back at them, the earlier cases had to do with people wanting to choose how their children were educated, that sort of thing. And yet those same cases were used with much different applications later on. So mm-hmm. I don't think you take the results you're looking at. You take the core constitutional principle
mm-hmm.
and try to be true to that.
So one of the comments you just made, that there might be a law that you disagree with, but if it's constitutional, you enforce it.
Yes.
And I think that's tied in with a lot of the certainly political conversation that's happening nationally around activist judges and who is and who isn't. How does that conversation come up in your work? Or,
well, as far as the term activist judge, I ordinarily someone gets that nickname or that handle because someone else doesn't like the application of something. And so they disagree with me and my feelings. They must be activist. And I think that those are more situational than anything else, frankly. If a judge starts listening to how the spin doctors play it later,
mm-hmm.
then they're listening to the wrong things. So you need to be serious about the law and about history, take your best shot, and then rabbit ears aren't appropriate at that point. Then if there's, let's take a law that I disagreed with. For example, I thought some of the mandatory minimum sentences for certain crimes were inappropriate, personally,
mm-hmm.
Too severe in some instances, not in every instance, but in some. And yet, for a period of time, when I was a judge, that was the law. These were required.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, those minimum sentences were put into place by a political process was dominated by those who were more liberal at the time. But it was a popular answer. And did I have the right to ignore the law? Well, if the judge won't follow the law, who will? So I felt obliged to go ahead and impose the sentence required. Now, I remember some defendants saying to me, for example, there's an offense called armed career criminal. And these aren't necessarily really bad offenses in some ways, but someone has involved firearms
mm-hmm.
in the offenses. And it can be as little as a robbery in which a firearm is stolen, frankly. And the mandatory minimum sentence for much of the time that I was there was 180 months, 15 years, no parole in federal court. And I remember sentencing one fellow, and he said, "Judge, it's too much. I'm just a thief who steals things to buy drugs." Well, frankly, he had a point. But that wasn't a point I could really acknowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a melancholy day for me.
Mm-hmm.
Those mandatory minimums have been eased a bit because of some Supreme Court cases in the last few years. But early in my career, there weren't the mandatory minimums. And we still tried to have guidelines of a sort. The judges met together every Monday noon
mm-hmm.
and looked at previous cases of similar offenses and tried to have a sense that made sense with respect to other cases.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Whether there needs to be the really draconian measure, I question that, frankly. Those are just my personal feelings. As a judge, I think I had to follow the law.
Well, and it is an issue that's come up in many of these oral history interviews, I think, of, you know, judges of a certain age who were on the bench prior and then since the imposition of them, and you know, there's definitely been a lot of questioning and trying to sort through, you know, what's appropriate and what's proper and how much those took away, you know, a judge's discretion and skill at determining what was appropriate.
But since Montesquieu sat in the south of France at Bred, in his castle with the moat, and wrote about the tripartite form of government, judges needed to allow the legislature the chance to make those laws. Mm-hmm. So early on, for example, I'm convinced then and now that these days drugs are a scourge to society. There was a time when I first started, I thought the laws might be too lenient. And frankly, it was breathtaking to me how fast my particular judgment in that regard was surpassed by the laws being toughened up. Things are better now. I think it's a good time right now in federal sentencing policy. I don't agree with, for example, if the legislature passes a law, I really don't agree with the administration ignoring them or the administrative part of government.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think judges can ignore what the legislature does as long as it's constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And there can be a question there with some of them, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't question another judge's judgment in that regard. These are tough decisions, and we sort of need to have compassion for each other as judges.
And when you're talking about the administration, do you have a specific example in mind, or?
Well, in the last week or two, there have been announcements that, well, certain laws we won't prosecute, or certain crimes. Now,
mm-hmm.
those are appropriate decisions overall. Believe me, there are books and books of laws that people could enforce. So to some extent, that's, of course, an appropriate part of the process, but it's not up to the administration to act like a legislature,
mm-hmm.
nor is it appropriate for the judiciary to act like a legislature.
Mm-hmm. While we're on the topic of labels, just as I've been doing my homework and
mm-hmm.
doing background research, the term conservative judge is often one that's associated with you,
mm-hmm.
As you came to the end of your judicial career. What's your take on that?
Well, my conservative friends think I'm liberal. My liberal friends think I'm conservative. And some cases or results
mm-hmm.
tend to show a certain thing. So, or at least in some folks' eyes. As I frankly would hope my personal lifestyle is somewhat conservative, but on the other hand, I'm somewhat of a Renaissance person too. I have interest in lots of areas.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to look at the design of our federal courthouse in Eugene and say that's a conservative design, I think you probably haven't looked at art history very much. So it's easier when you haven't actually had to deal with the issues to adopt labels. You know, labels are interesting because they make life easier.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to really think through relationships. There was one gentleman who was in an exercise class with me, and he said to me one day, because he was reacting to certain rulings that I made, or his understanding of them,
mm-hmm.
at least, and he said, "I don't get it. I thought I stood for everything you didn't stand for, but you seem like a nice person. Can you explain that to me?" none of that bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
We all face things from our own background, our own perspective, our own sort of experiences and so on. That's great. I frankly think you want judges who would change, but change slowly. That we need to have some stability in our legal systems, and
mm-hmm.
if that's conservative, I'm happy to wear that label. If someone would choose to follow the law rather than say, "Well, this is an exception," I made exceptions, but perhaps others would make them more often. I don't question that. That's just not the choice I made.
And when you talk about maybe a judge has changed, how can you recognize perhaps changes in your judicial style or your judicial viewpoints from the time you began as a magistrate and bankruptcy judge to the time of your retirement?
My work changed, I'll say that. In the early years, it was more on paper. And so there were some changes that resulted from that, because I did so much interaction with people in mediation later on. With regard to other aspects about my style, I hope not. I hope that I was patient on the bench. I hope that people felt respected. One of the publications that reviews judges, and there are lots of them, had something that was amusing to me. It said something like, be careful if he's smiling all the time because probably something bad's going to happen. Well, I don't mind that because I do like people, and I think that when I started, I hoped to treat people on the other side of the bench the way I like to be treated or have my family treated. And I hope that I did that throughout my career, that I didn't let the frustrations or the busyness of the job get in the way of that. After all, to be a judge is to be a servant of people, to be in the service business. And there are things that work against that because people call you Your Honor and call you a judge and so on. And the ego temptations of believing that can be difficult. So I would say to myself sometimes this little couplet: baptize me in the criticism of man so that I become immune to the praise of man.
Before we completely get away from significant cases, one of the ones that has been very prevalent across the nation, and I guess extending to other parts of the world as well, have been the priest sexual abuse cases within the Catholic Church.
Right.
And you were very involved in a couple of aspects of that. Talk a little about what was your involvement and how you used mediation to resolve those.
Well, the first significant involvement was with the Archdiocese of Portland. And I was brought in along with Judge Valour to try to mediate a bankruptcy result. There were about 150 claims in that case. There were also about 10 coverage cases with insurance companies. And many millions of dollars had already been spent on attorney's fees and expert witnesses. And so we took the tact of listening to each of the stories individually from people, trying to evaluate them and then encourage resolution. And that was after meeting with the insurance companies and trying to develop a fund of money so that there could be appropriate compensation for those folks. These problems are not just the problems that the Catholic Church has had, however. I've now handled at least hundreds, but possibly thousands of sex abuse cases. I have almost 200 claims under consideration right now. And to separate the wheat from the chaff, with regard to abuses and injuries that should never take place, that no child should have to bear, and that certainly cause profound injury and affect a lot of people's lives, not just that person, is a very serious matter. The institution shouldn't be thrown away, because there's much good that's done also. The cases themselves have have resulted in some good things in many institutions, because folks these days, because of the money that frankly this costs, as well as their own good intentions,
mm-hmm.
are doing a much better job and much better job in policing this matter and preventative work. And that's, if there's something good out of this, that's good out of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's better methods of counseling and so on, but these things need to be nipped in the bud, stopped early. And that is an acute need with organizations working with young people, and a much better job is being done of that. So with some of the big institutions I've handled a number of cases from, they really have quite sophisticated ways of trying to analyze whether they have someone who is a possible predator on children,
mm-hmm.
and that's appropriate, and it's deserving of the attention it's getting. Personally, it's depressing to work on those cases. And as a person of faith, you wonder how broad is grace. And all I can say is that with regard to the ideas of men and women, that those concepts are probably limited. And so to the extent someone can understand the grace of God, now he can look at this situation. You may have some small insight, but frankly, we are working with such difficult and tragic circumstances that that can be tough.
Mm-hmm.
So we soldier on and try to not let that sort of corrupt our view of human natures and human beings,
mm-hmm.
because everyone is valuable. And so the acts we need to be very tough with, and then look for redemption.
And then you also handled the bankruptcy filing and or kind of that piece of
yes.
the arch. I mean, all of that was involved in
yes.
creating the fund to, you know, compensate.
That's true.
And was that, were those kind of together or?
They were really together.
Mm-hmm.
They were separate efforts, but we had to get a bankruptcy plan confirmed. That was a part of it. I was fortunate that early in my career, I was a bankruptcy judge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, of course, familiar with the concepts. And some of my work these days is putting together bankruptcy plans that work. And there are some unusual challenges in getting a bankruptcy plan in a case like the diocese case, because there can be a class of future claimants who we don't even know about yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really an interesting challenge to try to figure out how to accommodate that. We did, and the type of tools we used have, or predictive tools, have been pretty accurate. And so others who may have had claims haven't been shut out of appropriate consideration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one element of that I wasn't completely clear of the scope of it was one of the rulings or stipulations that came out of those negotiations were the opening of records.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I guess I was interested in your thoughts about how that came about and sort of who brought up that issue and how that resulted in happening.
Well, plaintiff's attorneys were very interested in records becoming public. And frankly, it was appropriate. And I think I had the trust of both sides of these issues. My encouragement to those institutions that had records like this, in the diocese case, the Catholic Church, and other cases, other institutions,
mm-hmm.
is that it's better to go ahead and be open-handed about it, to open the records. And what I would say to them, otherwise you're going to die the death of 1,000 paper cuts. Let it all out at once. with regard to news stories, there will be a bad few days, depending on what the records show.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did to give them some comfort is that I reviewed hundreds of personnel files myself, and to decide which ones involved at least somewhat credible claims.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, those could be open. Others, having to do with other foibles of human nature, weren't really appropriate for that treatment. And so they were willing to live with me doing that. And I think it was probably painful for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I still think it was a good process and a good result.
Mm-hmm. And where in the process of resolving the lawsuits and the bankruptcy and the opening of the records, where did that fall in the process of that?
That really, the records part was really at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I brought some comfort to the Catholic Church in a way, because we had found some solution to this overarching set of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was some trust there, and also some trust from the plaintiff's bar, who saw their clients compensated, hopefully appropriately.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked about several sort of successful, very visible mediation cases that you were involved with. But I guess no one has a perfect record. And there certainly are a few mediations, one kind of in this same realm of abuse cases that involved both the Boy Scouts and the Mormon Church.
Yes.
That if my research is correct, the Mormon Church decided to negotiate a settlement and the Boy Scouts declined.
That's true.
And I guess I'm interested in an example of what happens when mediation doesn't come to a successful conclusion. How does that, and there may be many variations of that.
There are. Most mediations that I've been involved in are successful.
Mm-hmm.
By success, I mean the matter is resolved and we put it in the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm.
You've mentioned a series of, there were five cases involved in that. And it's true that one defendant settled, the other chose not to.
Mm-hmm.
There can be a good reason not to
mm-hmm.
Resolve a matter. Sometimes cases should go to trial. And it can set some parameters on what should happen in other cases.
Mm-hmm.
I encouraged that case not to go to trial, but I don't really criticize the decision. Wasn't mine to make, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And these were folks certainly who were informed and believed they were making the best choices. Going to trial before a jury has a certain amount of uncertainty to it. You really don't know who you're going to get on the jury. You don't know how the evidence is going to come in. There are lots of things you don't know. And I think to say in hindsight you made a mistake or not is not appropriate. Instead, that's just part of our situation. We look to the future.
Sure.
And there will be other cases go to trial in that area, and they should.
Mm-hmm.
And many should not.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very small percentage of cases that we're not successful with. But if we're not, that's okay. It was successful in a way, because we found out what people would do to resolve the case short of trial.
Mm-hmm.
And then parties get to make the decisions. The mediator does not. It's not appropriate that they make it. Here's what we can do in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can choose trial. And that can turn out lots of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Lawyers who say they've never lost a case have never had a difficult case to try factually. And every great lawyer will tell you they've won cases they should have lost and lost cases they should have won.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain part of this that's rolling the dice, as hard as juries try.
Mm-hmm.
And so, hindsight is helpful, but it's not everything.
Sure. Well, and I guess I was intrigued, and you commented briefly about, you know, it's up to the parties to decide whether to continue, not the mediator. And I wasn't really sure sort of who decides the path needs to change.
Yeah, they get to decide.
Mm-hmm.
Do both parties
have to decide jointly?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I've had the last couple of days, maybe 110 parties. They all have to decide they want to accept what we can put on the table.
Mm-hmm.
The case I mentioned earlier, dozens of parties.
Mm-hmm.
I've had 90 people walk into a mediation in the first meeting. They all have to decide to resolve the matter, and I don't get to decide anything.
Mm-hmm.
What I can do is try to help them to a situation where everyone has their needs met to a certain extent. And then they have to measure that against the risks, mm-hmm. and the time and the expense and the cost and just person power. And having done that, they get to decide.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that brings up another facet of this, which is sort of cost of going to trial and or, you know, some reading that I've done just talks about kind of the issue of mediation,
mm-hmm.
you know, more specifically, as kind of an area of concern that there's not as many trials as perhaps there should be to settle certain points of the law.
Right.
What's your take on that?
Some people think that it's all right. There's some principles that need to be litigated in court. But principle is a word that people will pull out pretty quickly. And it has a cost. So one of the things we do in mediation is I ask attorneys to budget for their clients what it will cost to get to the end of this, whatever the result is, or to get to the next step and mm-hmm. so on. And many times that's the first time that people have really weighed the cost of the path they're on. So they can come in and say, well, I don't mind spending extra money. I feel strongly about this. Good. That's a good thing. Now, you know how much money that is. So we go through it. Well, perhaps I could consider something else. And that happens often. They don't need to have that jammed down their throat. These are just getting the facts on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And then people can make their own decisions. I may encourage them. And I can tell them about those cases that have gone to trial because I'm a student of that. I need to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can say this, and you say you're going to get this result. But frankly, in that community, that's never happened ever before. And perhaps you'll be the person if you want to go through that, but you probably ought to listen to the voice of experience to some extent.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. And so you also, as you were speaking, mentioned, you know, maybe there are some cases that should go to trial.
Yes.
Can you define your process a bit more about as you're approaching a case, when it seems suitable for mediation and when it seems suitable to go to trial? How you make that distinction?
Well, I think I have to empower the parties to decide that. I don't really think it's up to me.
Okay.
There can be issues of governmental policy, for example, that are appropriate to go to trial. But it depends on the facts. Bad facts make bad law, no matter what the principle involved may be. And you can establish something through a trial that you really are sorry about for most cases. This particular case, it might be all right.
Mm-hmm.
But now you've established a principle that that throws a whole area off. And the good thing about a case going to trial is it can help establish goalposts so that attorneys have more to rely on in advising people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is important. So I think those things are there. But frankly, those are not the cases people come to see me in. They come to see me because they really know it's time to find a solution to a problem. Mm-hmm. Or a judge thinks that and sends them to me.
Mm-hmm.
That no, you're spending money that's a waste of money here. They still get to decide.
Sure.
But they were foisted on me for a time.
Well, and clearly mediation is a practice that you've long believed in and worked towards. And I know that you've also done some lecturing and some writing about the role of mediation. Perhaps expand a little more on why it's important for you to talk to others about that process.
Mm-hmm. Well, personally, I'm committed to reconciliation. So it fits what I believe in as a personal value.
Mm-hmm.
When I go out to others, for example, in a couple of weeks I'm speaking to large contractors about mediation. Not lawyers, but the contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will talk to them about what the real costs of going through the trial process is. The other thing I'll talk to them about is, wouldn't you rather make these decisions than having folks who don't deal with these issues every day deal with them? For example, I had a CFO of a large company in Oregon who was reluctant to resolve a matter. So I sat down with him and I said, I'd like to ask you to give me 1 hour, but not with me. I want you to go over to the courthouse and walk into any jury trial that's going on, and I don't want you to look at the judge or the attorneys or the court reporter or the witness. I just want you to spend 1 hour observing the jury, because in that box are your new CEO, your new CFO, your new human rights person. Everyone is there. Would you rather have them make the decision, or would you like to, based on your experience and background for your company? I will also help them do a little visualizing. And I'll say, okay, we have this much at risk, and to challenge this, it takes this much more.
Mm-hmm.
To really challenge it, now you're up, we have as much wagered on the process as you do on the product or the contract or whatever it may be. And wouldn't you rather do that? And frankly, in cases like that, in cases of big construction contracts, and there are many times of claims, only amateurs go to trial. And that's what I'll tell them. Mm-hmm. Which I truly believe, you get such untoward results because the jury is not going to be filled with engineers in the jury box, and perhaps this is an argument between engineers or experts in timing of construction, and there won't be anyone on the jury who really has had any background in that. They'll mm-hmm. try, they'll listen carefully, they'll do their very best. I believe in juries. But in that sort of really more sophisticated business decision, mm-hmm. There are very few cases that really ought to go to trial.
Mm-hmm. And so if you're talking about a talk you're going to give to contractors, when you're talking to law school students or members of the judiciary,
mm-hmm.
Do you make pretty much the same argument, or how do you talk about mediation as... I mean, here are people in law school who are thinking, you know, maybe there's more one way, or they're thinking they're going to be a trial lawyer, and you're right. Talking about this whole other approach.
Well, if I'm talking to law students, it's different than talking to lawyers who've been practicing a time or to judges.
Mm-hmm.
I've spoken to many of all of those groups.
Mm-hmm.
With law students, if they're interested in mediation, frankly, the best thing they can do is go out and get their nose bloodied a few times in litigation. It need to be the pragmatic aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can teach certain parts of certain interrelationships you have, but they're best taught in a kind of apprenticeship. So if they really want to learn about those parts, they need to work with someone who does it and who has done it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And but better that they just go out and get involved in litigation, frankly. Now, with judges and lawyers, it's different. So I've spoken to many of the federal judges in the country on mediating cases, and very few of them have used those things, although some have.
Mm-hmm.
It takes the right personality to do it. I spoke to a chief judge in the Midwest here a couple of years ago. There were a couple of cases in his court, and I said, would you mind if I came out to mediate these two cases? And he says, oh, that'd be wonderful. You're my mediation professor. You taught me mediation in Denver at a seminar and so on. And I said, that's great. How many cases have you mediated? He says, oh, I haven't done that. He said, I'd love to have you come and mediate these cases. So I've been all over the country and done that. But it has to fit
mm-hmm.
a personality. And then, you know, many judges don't want to really climb down off the bench and get involved in the mud and the muck.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some of that involved.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk to lawyers, I tell them what to look for in mediators sometimes. And so you say different things to them.
Mm-hmm.
You may say something like, you should look for a mediator that the other side trusts. That's sort of counterintuitive, but it's actually very important. No one can make you say yes. And so look for someone that the other side will have trust in or rely on. And that's much more important than whether you think they're your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would line up with you. And then I tell them, be sure, if you want to help your client, to sort of budget this situation for them. Try to tell them ahead of time. So I was in a bank failure case in Alaska, and one member of the board of this failed bank, and the FDIC was suing them, was a representative of a very large oil company who had many leases in Alaska. And before we got there, I said to the lawyer for that oil company, I want you to give a budget for your client of this case through trial. And when I got up there, I said, have you budgeted the case? And the client was sitting there, very important person within that oil company. Yes, I have. And I don't remember the exact amount now, but he had. I said, what was it? It was either $5 or $7 million. So I said, okay, I'll take it. And I may be able to tell you where I'd spend it, but I'll try to get you out of this mess. And the lawyer said, could I go out and talk to my client in the hallway to ask about this? And the client said, not necessary, Judge. If you can do it for that, please do it. So just the fact that he had done that,
mm-hmm.
Had he understood, we didn't have to educate him more. And then the other thing I will tell lawyers depends on whether they represent plaintiffs or defendants. So many times plaintiff's lawyers will want to sort of keep back something for a whole card or some information, and that's not the way to get the most money out of insurance companies. So I'll tell plaintiff's lawyers, for example, you need to think like an insurance company and the claims person at an insurance company. By the way, this person has pressures from both sides because you need to build their file for them so they can justify recommending it. Whatever amount of money, be it large or small. And because sometime that next year, some supervisor will come take a file off their shelf and say, here's what you've done, defend it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was that based on? So you need to help that claims person. And to think like that, that my job to be most effective for a plaintiff is to really build up this claims person for the insurance company is also counterintuitive. Isn't it? And then for a defense lawyer, something I may tell them, there are other things, of course, is that, you know, when you're taking a deposition of this plaintiff, if you want to go in and be tough, that's okay. But the madder you make them, the harder it's going to be to get this resolved. And so you should treat them with respect. And they shouldn't leave angry with you. They should leave thinking you understand their situation. If you do that, human nature is that they'll be able to accept what positions you take much easier. So when you're talking to lawyers,
mm-hmm.
it's more helping them to understand the psychology of the other side more than their own situation. And then you may talk to them about where, what the track record of this sort of case is in an area. If you're talking to judges, you want to help them to understand the process, because frankly, they generally want to weigh in on something, and they can weigh in mediation, but one of the things I will tell them, you can express your opinion, but not early, because if you do, one side will think you're lining up with the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to respect that and be a little reluctant to express yourself quickly. And you almost have to make them beg for it.
Well, which sort of brings up the point of, you know, whether it's in mediation or a trial, you know, one from the outside, I guess, one
yes.
presumes that all the parties are, but particularly the judge is, or the mediator is, using all the evidence that gets presented before
yes.
they make a decision, that the decision hasn't been made partway through.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair view of the situation?
No. in theory, yes. I agree with the studies that show that the most important part of the trial is the opening statement. And there are studies that show that attitudes are really very much formed
mm-hmm.
before the jury has heard one bit of evidence in the opening statement. And good trial lawyers, I think, will agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that we don't really have many Perry Mason moments in trials. Those things that happen during trials are not so much cases being won as cases being lost.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of missteps, but not so much, there aren't those light bulbs coming on necessarily. Because the good lawyers will always leave something for the jury to do. The text of the story is often not as important as the subtext. It's what type of person you're presenting, what is their attitude in this situation, and so on. So if you have a plaintiff's case, and you have a plaintiff who is bitter and angry and so on, and on the witness stand, they rarely will do as well as someone who is somewhat forgiving, is getting better, not worse, that sort of thing. Juries like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's human nature. And those things are as important as what they say, or more so.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So, I was going to move on to a new
mm-hmm.
topic, but if you have any thoughts about mediation that maybe I haven't touched on that you want to make sure get included here, this would be the perfect place.
No, I will tell you that I'm grateful that for all my time as a judge, and it was truly a sublime honor, but I did do 40 years there, and now I get to select the part of it I like best and do that 100% of the time, and that's wonderful also.
So there's certainly participation in professional organizations that play an important role in any legal career.
Yes.
And I don't know if you want to just talk about some of the significant ones that you were involved in, or you want me to mention them, and then you can comment about how you got involved or your interest in that particular
sure.
piece. One of them I know was you were active in the judicial conference.
Yes.
And elaborate on that.
All right. I served on the committee of the judicial conference that has to do with the administrative office, and they provide the wherewithal for judges to do their work.
Mm-hmm.
And guidance in that regard. That was interesting to me because I enjoyed being a part of developing national policy, that sort of thing. But that probably was an outgrowth of my work with the Magistrates Association nationally. And one of the most fulfilling things was being involved with the Magistrates Association and national president when we developed a new jurisdiction statute. And I had a chance to do really lobbying on that, or negotiating in Congress for that. And I think it's one of the very substantial improvements in the whole federal judicial system over the period of my career. And it's the growth and advent of the magistrate judge system.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning, I was involved with the members of Congress on both in both bodies, and was the only person invited to the staff joint committee between the House and Senate representatives, and had a chance to have a lot of influence in a meeting that's not recorded, of course, but these staff members had developed a confidence in me, and so my fingerprints are all over that particular jurisdictional statute, and I'm very proud of it, and very proud of the service that magistrate judges have been able to render in the federal court. It's frankly quite hard to get new district judgeships. It's a very political process, and the party that's not in the majority can be reluctant to create new judgeships when the other party's in the majority,
mm-hmm.
and that's just a fact of life. There was a period of time when you would see one of those jurisdictional statutes every 7 years, if you look back at the history. That hasn't been true now for a long time. In fact, probably since 91, when the position I was in was created. Since then, judicial politics has become much more adversary.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reluctance to create new judgeships has been greater. And it's short-sighted because if there was some regularity of the process, then it would tend to even out over time because the parties do ebb and flow.
Sure.
No matter how much it seems like they don't, if you look at it on a weekly basis, on a decade basis,
mm-hmm.
they do ebb and flow. And but nevertheless, that was very fulfilling. I enjoyed being president of a local American Inn of Court for a long time, and the whole idea behind that is lawyer education, but education in a relaxed atmosphere. So we would get together for dinner, lawyers from every side, and have an educational program and dinner, and then We adopted in our Inn of Court something used in the Inns of Court in London, where a young member would stand up, and we used a bell, actually, but then they would say, respectfully, I call for the port. And when the port was served, the educational part started. And I just thought it was more difficult for people to break bread together and the next day be nasty to each other. So the whole idea was to try to build a good educational tool, but also
mm-hmm.
Camaraderie,
mm-hmm.
so we can act like professionals, not just someone lining up on one side or the other.
And just to go back a bit with the U.S.
Yes.
magistrates,
yes,
that was in the 1980s,
yes,
that you were involved with that. And was that where you and your paths crossed with Peter McCabe?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But I met Peter when I first became a 1973, when I first became a magistrate and bankruptcy judge, and we just became friends, frankly. And since I was one of those rare combination positions,
mm-hmm.
I was sort of a different colored pin on the map. But also, he and I just got on well.
Mm-hmm.
And we both share a bit of a passion for red wine, and we've been to a lot of wineries together, too.
You know, there was a little story that came up when I was interviewing Peter a couple of years ago about the two of you at a winery in Napa, and wine being poured from one person to another in a Bota bag, and...
I was actually have a bottle, and Mrs. Mondavi was doing the pour.
That was it.
I guess I don't have to worry about that being in print anymore.
You get a review of your transcript.
Right.
And, you know, you've been a member of a couple of different bar associations,
yes.
And
uh-huh.
and what's your involvement been in that forum?
Well, I've certainly tried to help with the bar. I've served on committees of the state bar and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Been involved in lots of, as a speaker, in lots of educational forums.
Mm-hmm.
But not only there, but also out in community organizations. I think one of the things Judge Pandu is starting to bring a better understanding of the judiciary out to the broader community.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, that's difficult for some judges or to interact with the press very much, and some interaction with the press is not appropriate. But judges sometimes hold back because the press sometimes gets it wrong, or judges may think often gets it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's not a good enough reason, because people need to be able to understand what's happening with the courts. And there are things judges can do to make that better. One of the things I learned later in my career, and I told my law clerks when we were drafting opinions, I want the very first paragraph to be the news story. Everything you really need to know in the newspaper goes in the first paragraph. And if the reporter wants to just take that first paragraph, they've got the story. And since then, that reporting has been more accurate, frankly. They didn't have to sort of dig through and act like a beginning lawyer and try to figure out what I was really doing. So there are things judges can do to help
mm-hmm.
the press
mm-hmm.
or to help out in the public. If you go to a service organization, for example, and ask them the series of questions a new citizen is expected to know the answer to, and to see how they do with that. It's educational and revealing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that builds respect for those people who've become new citizens also. And so I think a judge should be available to be out and sort of put down the robes and not hide behind those, and also with lawyers to encourage interaction, even criticism. They will say enough good things to a judge. You don't have to worry about that, whether you deserve it or not. Instead, go out and try to have open discussions. I think that's good for the health of the bar and good for the judge
mm-hmm.
also, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So I've enjoyed that.
And do you think that's easier to do, meet with community organizations in kind of a smaller community like Eugene and the surrounding area than a large city like Portland, or that's irrelevant?
Oh, I don't think it's irrelevant. I think it probably is easier.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about being a judge in a smaller community is that you really have your life is very public
mm-hmm.
to everyone, and probably your foibles as well as your strong points. That's okay. You need to act with some discretion. And, you know, we have the Caesar's wife analogy. There are certain things that Caesar's wife should not probably do for the respect of the government. The same is true for the courts. And that's okay. And I do think you're probably more available in a small community. You're expected to be present at community celebrations and activities, at charitable events. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... In fact, that's the way I like it. So I would rather not be in the ivory tower.
And I think the other organization that I was aware of was the Ninth Circuit Executive Committee.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But I don't know much beyond that you were involved with it, so elaborate.
Well, I was. There is an executive committee that really is the policymaking and governing body, and handles problems for the circuit. And I was not only that on that, but during a year or two, there was an executive committee of that committee, and there were just three of us, actually. And it's good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
You work with some wonderfully talented people, and do have a chance to help with policy and to try to see that the courts make more sense, so that certain types of procedures are not costing too much, don't have too big a lawyer fees involved. You can do some policy things like
mm-hmm.
that. You also deal with the problems that come up, and it's a good thing, because it's better if the judiciary does its own laundry rather than make a big public scene of something.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to be careful about it and do a good, thorough job. And so those parts of the job. We'll go away with history now, but they're important,
mm-hmm.
and it was a privilege to be in that spot for a time.
And what period of time were you involved in? I don't know whether you get appointed or you...
You are, but it was a several-year period, and mm-hmm. then for a couple of years, there were just kind of three of us who were the folks who handled the day-by-day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And are there any work that you did along these same lines that I'm missing that you
want
to make sure that...
Not really. I've participated in lots and lots of meetings with judges and lawyers, and one of the real fun things to be was the chairman of the Ninth Circuit Educational Conference, where 700-800 judges and lawyers come together from the West. And the hard year, frankly, is the year before you're the chair. The year before that, you're in charge of the program. That's the hard working year. But then chairing the meeting, and it's kind of wonderful to be able to contribute to not only education, but interaction between judges. Those meetings are important, not just for the educational aspect. Some would encourage those things to happen by video or in writing, but judges need to rub shoulders with each other and kind of have the chance to informally interact about various issues in front of them. And so those, I think those meetings are awfully important. They get criticized a little these days because they cost money.
Mm-hmm.
It's money well spent. And I encourage folks to keep paying for those. You're going to have better justice, better judges because of it.
Great. Well, I want to let you get out of
okay.
here on time, so we'll conclude for today. Thank
All right.
you.
Thank you. Thanks, Jan.